Guardian Unlimited.
Oogie Wawa, everyone. I'm Alok Jha, and this is Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited, the science podcast that likes to raise its glass and propose a toast, and then proceeds to make an utter arse of itself as it falls apart in front of guests and dignitaries. On this week's show, Professor Raymond Tallis joins us in the pod to tell us why we all need to have greater appreciation of what science has given to modern life. Plus, how psychologists are using a computer game to combat post-traumatic stress for soldiers serving in Iraq. And we'll be finding out why an aristocrat who died almost 100 years ago may hold a key to the fight against bird flu. So calm down, everyone. It's only Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited. After a dismal showing in the pod last week, I'm delighted to report that we have the full crew in the studio this week. Science correspondent James Randerson is back from a fortnight's holiday or something or other, don't know what, and even turned down an appearance on Richard and Judy to be here today. Hello, James.
I hope my next holiday is more fun.
Tech correspondent Bobby Johnson is also here. He hasn't been asked to be on TV.
I was on Irish radio, though.
Well done. And lastly, hello to our First Lady of Science, who certainly should be on TV. It's Nell Bowes from Guardian Unlimited's arts blog.
Hello.
Pod Squad, the pleasure is all mine. Now, our special guest this week is a poet and a playwright, a philosopher and an author. And if that weren't all enough to keep him off the streets, he's also a doctor and the Emeritus Professor of Geriatric Medicine at the University of Manchester. He's just given the annual Sense About Science lecture to a star-studded audience, including TV's very own Derren Brown and our favourite Lewis Wolpert. Professor Raymond Tallis, welcome to the pod. We've discussed the stuff that you've been talking about many times in the pod before, the idea that science has given us a lot to be thankful for. But can we just go straight in with something that you mentioned? I mean, why do people still find pseudoscience so attractive?
It is mysterious, isn't it? I mean, after all, it should have nothing going for it. It's ineffective and it's cognitively quite primitive. It mistakes anecdotes for data and so on. So a half-educated public should laugh it to scorn. So what is the allure of junk science? Well, first of all, it very much depends on the argument from authority. And junk science often appeals to people who like to associate ideas with faces, with celebrities and so on. Perhaps more importantly, it parasitizes the language of real science. It uses terms like reflex and immunology and so on. So it looks like the real thing. Often it has a kind of intuitive appeal. It seems to sort of fit with a kind of common sense. And we know from bitter experience, of course, that the truth about nature doesn't fit with common sense.
Well, I was going to say, do you think that this sort of stuff, pseudoscience, is attractive to people simply because it's a comfort blanket? And people don't want to know that you can't cure cancer. Mm. They want to know that actually this pill will cure cancer, and then they don't want to have to think about it. They're scared of the world around them, so they look for easy answers.
I think that's true. And I think the attractiveness of junk science, in the case of people who are very seriously ill and whom perhaps conventional medicine and whatever has failed, is particularly poignant because it does seem to make sense of illnesses which otherwise seem like a senseless intrusion on one's body.
James, you were at the talk that Professor Tallis gave, and what was the sort of response there?
Well, certainly there was a lively debate afterwards about how to tackle these problems. But I wanted to actually, you had some very powerful examples of how science has improved our lives. Perhaps you could tell us a bit about some of them.
Yes, because I was very concerned that in enhancing our appreciation of science, we should not only increase people's understanding of it, but also celebrate science and what it's achieved. I particularly focused on my own area, which is medicine, and on the huge advances that have been made in longevity and in also in health. I mean, just take some headline figures. Worldwide, average life expectancy has almost doubled since 1800, between 1800 and 2000. If we look at what's happening in somewhere like the UK, life expectancy is increasing by about 2 years for every decade that passes.
Some people might argue that those 2 years are not the best 2 years of your life, if you like. You know, we may be increasing the lifespan of people, but, you know, people are spending a lot of time in nursing care and things like that. Is that the case, or is that a myth?
Well, all lives end in a mess. We all die. And so, of course, at the end of life, there will always be illness and problems of various sorts. But if you look at the data, the trends suggest that the increase in life expectancy is also associated with an increase in healthy life expectancy. And in fact, in certain countries such as Denmark, the period of ill health before death is actually shrinking, despite increase in life expectancy. That's not true universally, but it shows you what is possible. And that is in part due to the fact that we're getting better and better at preventing major disabling diseases such as stroke.
Professor Tallis, how do we deal with people who still think that the MMR vaccine, for example, causes autism? These people who maintain this sort of this position, and despite all the data and how many studies, how many Cochrane reviews there've been, they won't move from that. And do we just ignore it, or do we have to fight it somehow?
Well, I've always thought we should be tough on unreason and tough on the cause of unreason. And if we look at the particular situation with MMR, we obviously needed to deal with that as a particular issue. I think on the whole, science has won out. There are a few diehards, obviously, who still feel that MMR is associated with autism. But if you look at what's happening, uptake of the MMR jab is increasing. People realise now that there was absolutely no basis whatsoever.
So there might be people making a fuss, but actually deep down, people are, the general public sort of smarter than all that.
Well,
give us a bit of hope.
I think the science has ultimately won out. I mean, still the immunisation rates are not as high as they should be. And of course, we had an outbreak of measles, which was totally avoidable earlier in this year, which wouldn't have happened if we hadn't had this utterly unfounded scare. But I think we need to look beyond the particular instances of unreason to look at the underlying causes. And I think some of it is really due to lack of science education in the real sense, a lack of understanding of what is necessary in order to establish robust knowledge, a lack of understanding methodology.
Nell, you've got a question.
I was just interested, actually, in talking about geriatric medicine and maybe junk science or mavericks. We had Aubrey de Grey in here a couple of weeks ago, and I wondered whether you were familiar with his work and what you thought of it.
Yes, I mean, I smile a little when I hear it. I mean, of course, we can make predictions of massive increases in longevity. I think the most robust prediction is one that was published in Science 2 or 3 years ago, which suggested if the trends continue as they are at the moment, by 2060, in at least one country, life expectancy of birth in women will reach about 100. We're not talking about 150, 200, 300. Who knows, there may be breakthroughs in the future. But at the moment, we have no good evidence to assume that people are going to have those kinds of life expectancy.
Just to remind everyone, Aubrey de Grey from Cambridge University was talking about living to 1,000. No, he wasn't from Cambridge University, was he? We made that mistake before, in fact. Anyway, he's living to 1,000. Well, thank you for that, everyone. We'll be hearing more from Professor Tallis throughout the show. And we want to know what you think, of course. Is science a special form of knowledge, and should it be treated as such? Or are we just indulging in too much navel-gazing about it all? Email us at science@guardian.co.uk or post a blog at guardian.co.uk/science/podcast. I'm Alok Jha, and you're listening to Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited. Still to come, we'll be finding out why Wikipedia's invoked the wrath of God. Plus, debunking a Hollywood myth, and believe me, you don't want to miss that. But first... That's the sound of Virtual Iraq, part of a pioneering new psychological trial that's aiming to help soldiers overcome post-traumatic stress from their time in the war zone. The software, which is being developed in California, has been tested on a few dozen ex-servicemen with some interesting results. James, you met the team behind this. Tell us a bit more.
Yeah, it's a chap called Skip Rizzo. No, seriously, that's his name.
That's not a real name.
The idea here is that it's a kind of extension of imagination therapy, which is a kind of traditional technique where you talk people through their traumatic events. So, for example, you know, maybe a suicide bomber has tried to blow up their Humvee, and you get them to, you know, talk them through the event from start to finish. You know, it's quite a traumatic experience, I think, even just talking through it. What they do here is they sort of make it even more real and even more potent. The doctor is there, able to manipulate what's happening to them in the virtual environment, and allows them to kind of experience almost what they're saying. But anyway, I spoke to Professor Skip Rizzo, and he told me more about it.
What we try to do is maximize the number of senses that we can deliver this type of simulation content. So we have, you know, of course, the visuals, We have good audio, and it's directional, so a sound may appear to be coming from one direction or another direction. We have the vibration running through the floor, through the person's body, and we also have smell. I think that the visuals simply set the stage to get the person back in a specific environment. The sound drives specific emotional reactions. So somebody may get used to walking through a city, but then when an explosion occurs and they hear that, all of a sudden that drives an emotional experience for the person. That sound in combination with the vibration that they feel, the concussive force, adds tremendously to that experience, so that feeling it in addition to hearing it helps to immerse the person in the environment and make more relevant exposure experiences. Now the smell, this is something that we're testing out. We don't have any objective data in terms of, you know, what is the specific number in terms of additive value of smell, but we are resting this on theory, the theory that smell is important for emotion and for memory, because the olfactory system links directly up with the limbic system, which handles emotion and memory. And we all have had experiences where we smelled something and it brought back a memory from 20, 30 years ago. So we don't know how much smell adds to it, but we feel in this case we want to maximize what we can deliver to the patients to produce a good therapeutic effect. And then in the years after, then we'll begin to parse out how much does smell matter, how much does sound matter, how much does vibration matter.
And what kind of smells have you got?
The smells that we use in Virtual Iraq are based on what people have reported as being relevant, and also, again, things that match the specific scenery that we present. So we have smells in Virtual Iraq of gunpowder, cordite, burning rubber, diesel fuel, body odor. And don't laugh, because body odor is quite relevant when you're in an environment where you get a lot of people that can't necessarily shower every day. And Iraqi spices. I know I'm forgetting one. A new one that we're putting in is cooked meat, like a barbecued lamb kind of a scent. Because that was reported by many of the returning soldiers as a smell that they picked up quite frequently with people cooking outdoors. You know, people don't have electricity, tend to barbecue maybe a little more. And we're constantly looking for ways to enhance the smell. Now, people have asked questions like, do you have the smell of death? Do you have the smell of burning flesh? We don't have that. I'm not sure if we need to go to that level of intensity in our stimulus hierarchy, so to speak, but it's something that we're considering and exploring. I don't know what the smell of death is and how we would replicate it, and so I'm not sure if we'll go in that direction. Burning flesh, I don't know. I think there's a lot of, I just heard about somebody suggesting, she's playing around with the application, she suggested the smell of blood can be acquired by taking iron pills and grinding them up and putting them into the system and blowing the air over them, and it gets us this kind of a irony smell. And so this is something we're going to explore as well.
That was Professor Skip Rizzo, the man with the best name in science. Professor Tallis, tell us, what do you make of this this experiment?
There's quite a lot of questions I'd like to ask. We have a principle in medicine which is first do no harm. And I would like to know how the trial is designed in such a way as to ensure that it's producing more benefit than side effects. Mm. Because potentially it's an extremely unpleasant experience. And we know that some other use of counsellors and stress counsellors and so on have actually produced very negative effects. And I hope he's designing a trial properly to ensure it produces more benefit than harm.
James, do you know anything about that?
Well, yes. I mean, that was a question that came up, because even to the naive observer, it seems rather counterintuitive to throw someone back into the very situation that has traumatised them in the first place. His argument was, you know, we don't throw them straight in at the deep end. We move up the level of realism step by step and watch them at each stage. So, for example, if the problem was a suicide bomber who blew up their Humvee, then, you know, you start off in the environment with no, just with the head, the goggles on, with no smell or no hearing. And if they're sort of fine with that, then you put the Humvee next to them and you get them to talk through what happened. And then maybe you get them to get into the Humvee and start driving it, and then things start happening. But I mean, I agree with you. I mean, obviously, I'm no expert in this area. It seems one could perhaps go that little bit too far and do an enormous amount of damage. I don't know.
There's a huge amount of work being done on shell shock victims using rather similar therapies, as it were, reminiscence therapy. This is a combination of reminiscence therapy and desensitization, it seems to me. And I just think it's, they have a moral obligation to make sure that they're doing a proper trial.
Well, thanks, everyone here. If you've got anything else to add on this, listeners, get in touch in the usual way. Send us an email to science@guardian.co.uk or post a blog at guardian.co.uk/science/podcasts. And now it's time for a roundup of the other news making the headlines from the worlds of science and technology. I'm going to start us off. It's the latest twist in the cloned embryo saga. You've probably heard enough of this from me, but this week, scientists were giving evidence to the Science and Technology Committee for the House of Commons, again on this issue of creating hybrid embryos for stem cell research. You might remember that the government, the British government that is about to put through a white paper that will ban the creation of these hybrids, which scientists want to use to increase the numbers of stem cells they have. Raymond, can I ask you about this, actually? This is a really good example of something that you were talking about earlier. This is a case of government minister just spooked by newspaper headlines into banning something which could potentially save thousands of lives in the future.
Absolutely. I mean, this is a good example of the misapplication of a principle that's often used at present, which is the precautionary principle. In this case, it's taking precautions against public outrage, which is unlikely to take to actually materialise. It's a fear of fear, I guess, or third order fear by politicians that are now so cowed by popular feeling that they don't actually show any leadership.
We'll move on. James, why could a long-dead Yorkshireman hold the key to preventing the spread of bird flu?
The unfortunate chap died in February 1919 of the Spanish bird flu strain that kind of ripped through the world at the time, the pandemic that killed millions of people. So Mark Sykes, who is the sixth baronet and our diplomatic man at the talks to carve up the Ottoman Empire. So he's got a lot to do with the shape of Turkey today, I think. But by extracting the DNA of the virus from his body, hopefully scientists will be able to tell some useful things about the virus.
It's terrifying that it's been around that long. Bobby, moving on to something completely different. What's Stephen Hawking been up to?
He's been preparing to go floating. Professor Hawking is
drugs,
no. This is purely physical. He's decided that he wants to maybe, if not going to space, he's already said he wants to go on Virgin Galactic. But you know, we'll see whether that turns up. He is, however, going on a zero gravity flight, which you know is really interesting. As he says, he's studied gravity pretty much his whole career, and this is a chance for him to get up there in space and float around, or not in space, and float around a bit. I wanted to throw this back at you, Alok, because you've experienced exactly the same thing.
I have done this. It's the weirdest feeling in the world. I don't know how Stephen Hawking is going to deal with it with his massive brain, but for my simple sort of human brain, I was told by the flight doctor you get a briefing before you go up on one of these flights, basically, which is they fly in 20 parabolas and you experience all sorts of different G-forces and things. And the flight doctor said that basically, because your brain gets so confused, it does what it does. The only thing it knows what to do in that situation, which is to make you vomit hugely. Now, in its short lifespan, Wikipedia has become almost as vital an internet destination as Google, MySpace, YouTube, and guardian.co.uk/science. The website, of course, bills itself as the encyclopedia that anyone can edit. And last time we checked, the English language version contains 1.6 million articles across 7.7 million pages. And since it began life in July 2002, its 3 million users have made more than 116 million edits. That's a lot of millions. But it seems not everyone's a fan. Bobby, you're our tech man. Explain what's going on.
Over the past few weeks, people have been noticing a site called conservapedia.com. It's produced by a group of right-wing Christian Americans who think that there are lots of problems with Wikipedia from a kind of editorial standpoint.
I mean, it's right.
And
occasionally.
We'll get into that. But basically, they think it doesn't fairly represent them, that the edits they make to Wikipedia are politically motivated. They're kind of coming up with their own version, which has some really interesting examples. I think if we throw over to Nell,
Nell, I was going to say, Bobby talks about websites all day long, and you actually make them. So go on, give us some examples.
I did actually go and have a quick look at Conservapedia, and sadly, some of the best entries have now been toned down somewhat. But they still have the entry on Cole Porter, which reads, "Because Porter was a homosexual, we conclude that anything goes was his philosophy of life." Many atheists
might well have been.
No, many atheists have adopted this song as a description of their moral code, moral in scare quotes, which I just, it's just lovely. I can't believe it isn't a joke.
Professor Tallis, what do you make of this?
I like Wikipedia for three reasons. First of all, it is a very good resource for, you know, often matters of fact. Secondly, it does actually put caveats along lots of its articles that they need further editing. And thirdly, I don't know who did my entry, but described me as one of the top 100 intellectuals in the world. And I thought this magazine, this encyclopedia,
he knows what it's doing.
Someone should start fact checking. Yeah.
It's quite interesting because they brought out some more research on Wikipedia and how it's working this week. And they were actually, because at the beginning it was very much kind of oligarchy. There were a few kind of top 100 people who created it and sort of posted on it, and it's now become much, much more democratic. And that those top 100 posters make up about 10% of
I mean they still do have a group of the volunteer editors who have more power than other people. Is still somewhere around 600 the last time I spoke to Wikipedia. But I think the interesting thing is that the guys behind Conservapedia really seem to think that there's a demand for what they're doing, and B, that they can make it work. I mean, people all over the internet have been piling onto Conservapedia and making all kinds of stupid changes to it.
Did you have to believe in God to be an editor on?
It probably helps, I think.
Is it the internet version of Fox News?
That's probably not a bad way of putting it. I'm sure a lot of Fox News viewers will be happily
logging
on.
Bobby, seriously though, I mean, the internet community is really good at sort of self-regulating and making sure that the anything that is nonsense is weeded out fairly quickly. Not always, but fairly quickly. Well, what are people worried about this, really?
No, I don't think they're going to worry about it too much. I mean, Jimbo, who runs, who started Wikipedia,
Jimbo
Wales,
is your mate. Is your mate? Is he?
Yeah, has said that, you know, everyone's free to do what they like. The Wikipedia model isn't, you know, it's not proprietary. They don't care that someone's copied it. And I mean, frankly, people, I think, are clever enough in, you know, it may not be a smart mob, but there's a mob that doesn't necessarily stand for all this kind of stuff. I mean, I think go on to Conservapedia and see if they've got an entry for the flying spaghetti monster. And and when that's happened, I think, yeah, you'll see where things are going.
Professor Tallis, I'll give you the last word on this. Does this fit into your thesis of people sort of trying to get nonsense information out there, promoting anti-science stuff?
I mean, that's certainly true. But just a word for Wikipedia. I think it represents a tremendous generosity of spirit. Basically, it is the desire to spread knowledge. Okay, you can sometimes spread knowledge and ignorance in equal quantities. I don't think that's true of Wikipedia. And I think it is a bit in the spirit of the encyclopedists, you know, in 18th century France, wanting to get knowledge out there. And so on the whole, I'm in favour of it. I also use it a lot.
We're almost done for this week, but before we go, sit back in your chair, grab your popcorn, and get ready for our feature presentation. Yeah, you're probably wondering why we're playing that. Well, it's because we're about to debunk a classic Hollywood myth. Whenever a bad guy wants to kill a hero, he douses him in petrol and throws a cigarette at him to create this. That's right. Explosions. James, on your holiday, you found out that's nonsense, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, if you do find yourself tied up, covered in petrol, with someone standing over you with a lighted cigarette...
Usually with an Eastern European accent. Relax, yeah.
It's fine, because they're not going to be able to kill you that way. Despite the fact that the ignition temperature of petrol is 246 degrees centigrade, and the temperature of a lighted cigarette is 700 degrees centigrade, or if you're sucking on it, it's 950 degrees
or
centigrade.
Or in English, we call that a lit cigarette.
The question is, what happens though? You'd think it would light the petrol. It makes sense. It doesn't. There's a guy called Rick Tongtarsky, who's an expert.
You're just making all these names up today.
They're Americans. That's why they've got names like this. Rick Tongtarsky, he's a very serious forensic fire investigator at the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco and Firearms Research Lab in Maryland. He spent a lot of time working out whether you can light petrol with a cigarette. And he did this more than 2,000 times. He dropped lit cigarettes into pools of petrol. Seriously, and it doesn't light. The reason he was doing this is because quite often in forensic circumstances, you get defendants in murder cases who turn around and say, the burning of my girlfriend was an accident, honest governor. No, seriously, people say this. They say, you know, she was smoking and by accident I spilled some petrol on her and she went up in flames. You know, and every time he has to stand up in front of a jury and say, no, that's not possible. And so what he wanted to do is get some really, really hard evidence that it's just impossible to do this.
You know, I'm not sure I necessarily, even with the 2000 experiments, I'm not sure whether I believe this or not. It sounds so counterintuitive. Mm. Raymond, what do you think?
Well, I think there's a case here of a randomised clinical trial. We just need to
throw
get a few
petrol
volunteers.
On people.
Absolutely.
Throw
absolutely.
Some petrol on yeah. people. Yeah. Nell, what yeah. about you?
I was just going to say, we love this story on the arts blog because we then decided to go and have a look at all the other laws of physics that didn't quite work in the movies, including explosions in space and whether it's possible to get on in the police force without being labelled a maverick. So if you've got any, go and add. This is a blatant plug. Go and add them on the arts blog.
Go and add them on the arts blog. We'll put a link on. Yeah, go and add them. James, let's move on to the other stuff that you found out.
Yeah, no, some really interesting
stuff. Some gruesome stuff.
Yeah, there was some quite gruesome stuff. There was one chap who was, I don't know if anyone's seen the movie Fargo, but at the end of that,
good movie.
The protagonist puts his murder victim through a wood chipper. And this has actually happened a few times in the US, people trying to get rid of the evidence of a body. And this one chap put lots of deer bones through a wood chipper to find out what they look like on the other side. So you can try and work out what was used to crush up the bones. And he compared this with, he had loads of students smashing up bones with hammers. And, you know, you can look at the debris and say, well, these were smashed up by a hammer and these were smashed up by a wood chipper. Another good one was there in Chicago. In Chicago, they've had a problem recently with lots of drug overdoses, apparently from heroin. When they started testing it, they found actually it's sort of fake heroin. It's not heroin at all. It's a drug called fentanyl, which is an anesthetic. Now, the trouble with fentanyl is that it's difficult as a kind of drug user to get the dose right. It's very easy to go from, you know, high to dead. And so they were getting lots of these corpses turning up and, you know, they were realising they were pumped full of fentanyl. And so the local law enforcement put out a press release saying, you know, drug users, try, you know, be really careful, there's all this fake heroin going around, it's really dangerous. This was completely counterproductive because all of the drug users started going out and actually seeking this stuff out.
Because they felt it was going to be like heroin.
It acquired this sort of specialist nickname of drop dead. And they were all going out and trying to get this stuff, and there was a massive wave of deaths in response to this press release. So, some people just don't want to help themselves.
Okay, well, that's it for this week's programme. If you want to comment on anything you've heard in the show, email us at science@guardian.co.uk or post a blog at guardian.co.uk/science/podcasts. You'll find a full archive of our pods on the site and details of how to subscribe to the show on iTunes. And by the way, we're only 1,000 listeners away from overtaking Newsdesk, the Guardian's daily news show, so come on, you know what to do. That just leaves me to thank everyone in the pod. That's James Randerson, Bobby Johnson, Nell Bowes, and of course our special guest, Raymond Tallis. Science Weekly is produced by Ben Green, and I have been Alok Jha. See you next time.
Guardian Unlimited.